title is Why the Narcissistic Personality in Our Time. And by way of starting, I'll just read here, and then we'll have time, I hope, for discussion. Every so often, in no predictable manner, a broadly conceived new interpretation of where we are and why we are where we are in America, you know, suddenly sort of appear. Readers respond favorably to some of these new books because the author has been able to take hold of many seemingly, you know, disconnected but well-known trends, hunches, developments, and the rest out of the immediate present and puts these into a very provocative, meaningful interpretation. Such titles by way of illustration come to mind as David Riesman's The Lonely Crowd in 1950 and certainly Harvey Cox's Secular City in 1965, which had sort of a meteoric, you know, up and down, and it's almost fun to kind of to giggle to think that we actually took that book very seriously in 1965. But we did. But anyway, so too this book, The Culture of Narcissism by Christopher Lash, which came out last year, and it's now in paperback, and we're just starting. And the critics and the scholars are still responding to it either with great enthusiasm or in very sharp dissent. But I think for right now, and that's all we can say about it, since it is a book for now, it is a very important book, and it brings together, I think, in a very clear and certainly in a very provocative way, many of the developments and trends that we've been talking about here at Holden and have been talking about, you know, in many different circles, and I've put these into, I think, a very significant pattern. And what I'd like to do is use the book as a starting point for discussion for these next four Thursdays. Generally, what I'll try to do is outline the main argument and then leave time for discussion. And as we talked about, after tonight, there's going to be Vespers at 5, and then apparently this program will be at 6:30, so there'll be time if anybody wants to stay afterwards for discussion. Just a little bit about the author. Christopher Lash is a well-known American historian. He teaches at the University of Rochester. He's brought out several very stimulating books, always very crisply argued, always very provocative, and one simply can't go away from Lash without having very sort of strong reactions either one way or the other. And the second thing, by way of introduction with Lash's book, he states very freely that he is much more of a critic than he is of a builder. That is, he is much more concerned in pointing out and discussing what's wrong with American life than he is, in this book at least, in finding constructive alternatives to what he sees as wrong as a decline in quality in our lives. He does have, it should be said, rather clear, if muted by muted criteria by which to evaluate today's world. It isn't, though, that he just is out, you know, freely swinging around. He does uphold certain values and has very clear-cut commitments himself, or priorities, but these I think we can probably save to the last hour this month. Okay, now let me outline briefly his major argument so far as why we're getting the what he calls the narcissistic personality, you know, in the 1970s. Because I think, yeah, Tom's the only one who's heard me say this before here, and that one thing a historian always has to do is explain not only why did something happen, but why did it happen when it did. Historians are always preoccupied, you know, with chronology. Why did it happen at this particular time? Why didn't it happen, say, 10, 15, 20 years later? And that's what I want to try to talk about a little bit today. All right. His basic argument is this. In every important area in American life today, in government, in family, in education, in the field of morality, entertainment, sexuality, whatever, America, he argues, has lost its once vital capacity to generate hope, confidence, and commitment by its people, to being able to create and sustain a better life than the present generation has it. That is, to put it another way, perhaps, American confidence in its capacity to lead the free world, to provide hope for the downtrodden and the opportunity, you know, for everybody who will contribute to American life has disappeared. You know, suffering from a tremendous really lack and loss of confidence in all areas. Let me read here, and I quote, "Those who recently dreamed of world power now despair of governing the city of New York," which is, I think, is a nice little illustration for this sort of thing. "Defeat in Vietnam, economic stagnation, and the impending exhaustion of natural resources have produced a mood of pessimism in higher circles which spreads through the rest of society as people have lost faith in their leaders. Bourgeois society," and he comes from a sort of a neo-Marxist position, "bourgeois society seems everywhere to have used up its capacity in the will, excuse me, to confront the difficulties that threaten to overwhelm it." And with this, "in some, the leaders of our society, in government, education, business, and the rest, have nothing but gloom, show nothing but gloom in trying to plan for the future. And here, I think, up to this point, his argument is familiar enough that because of the various crises, let's say in ecology, Watergate, Vietnam, all the rest of these things, inflation, that, you know, we really don't know what to do. And we're sort of, you know, casting about. I think that's a fairly familiar enough argument. And we don't need sort of a lash to tell this, but I think he goes on to sort of document why this should be the case and why we are sort of floundering the way that he, the way that we are. What he argues is that unless some drastic turnabout in our values and our commitments and especially our self-discipline is forthcoming, he argues that America will decline and finally disappear as a viable civilization. Now, the question becomes why? And he argues that the basically it's that the ideology with which the country got its start in the 18th, you know, the latter part of the 18th century, simply no longer is viable today. For instance, in the 18th century, the great sort of scheme which was to regulate and direct our economic life was based, you remember, on Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, with the idea being that if everybody pursued their own economic self-interest, some sort of invisible hand would see to it that the best interests of all were served with this. And he argues that what's happened is that the culture of competitive individualism, such as was postulated by Smith, has carried the logic of individualism to the extreme of a war against all. That is, that since we all are all pursuing our own individual interests, there is no longer a sense of cooperation or community at all. Or take the other great ideal of the 18th century when our nation was founded. Remember Jefferson's famous phrase, the pursuit of happiness. What has happened, he argues, is that the pursuit of happiness has now reached the dead end of a narcissistic preoccupation with a self. The pursuit of happiness means the pursuit of my happiness, regardless of what might happen to anybody else. All right. Now, what he sees basically as the explanation for this, and here I have to go into a little detail, is the end of a specific era in American life and the beginning of another. He argues here primarily from both what we could call economic and psychological, you know, terms. Sorry. He argues that American political liberalism has been and economic liberalism has been the dominant ideology in the last, let's say, 30 or 40 years. Now, liberalism, as he defined it, rests on the assumption that once the basic economic needs, you know, of a society and the individuals were fulfilled, then that government had done all that it could do to provide for the best interests of the society itself. He argues that basically what has happened is that the government has assumed that providing a welfare state and for the economic needs of the people, such as full employment, economic security, social security, and all these things, once that these goals have been achieved, that you know, the people would be content. But what's happened in the 1970s, especially in our, you know, in our economy of abundance, is that the idea of fulfilling the needs of economic men, or economic man, as he would put it, has left people emotionally empty. That is to say that by fulfilling the economic needs, taking care of all the economic needs that the government has done, that there is simply no longer any real meaning, nothing of ultimate value or permanence left for the people. All right. So here's where he makes sort of the transition, his argument. So with this void, that is, having filled the economic needs of the people, but finding, you know, the economic needs still unmet, he argues that in our time, especially in the 1970s, for reasons which I'll document in a little while here, that economic man has given way to what he calls psychological man of our times, and what he calls the final product of bourgeois individualism. We have, in other words, a new kind of person, not any longer motivated by economic needs, such as where it was the case, let's say, in the Depression. No longer motivated by economic needs, but now motivated primarily by psychological needs. And then he swings into his famous indictment here. Psychology has become the new religion, the new way of explaining everything. We need to know about the human condition, about human nature, the nature and destiny of man, and instead of turning to organized religion for the answers, we have turned to the field of psychology, especially pop psychology, especially the whole human encounter movement, which I'll talk about a little bit later. I can only give just one illustration of this. For a couple of years, I lived in a South Minneapolis suburb called Burnsville, which is rapidly replacing Edina as the ultimate place to achieve in the Twin Cities. And they have a clinic out there, a medical clinic called the Ridges, and with a medical staff and all the rest. And they started off with a very small counseling staff. But within 3 years after the medical clinic had started, the counseling staff quadrupled in size while the medical staff held its own in terms of numbers. It's a growth industry in psychology. Counseling, you know, from everything from womb to tomb. They are there. They're just enormous numbers of people. In other words, as he puts it here, therapists have replaced priests. Encounter groups have become the substitute for corporate religious worship. And in his search for meaning through psychology, today's American has become or has taken on the classical archetype in psychology of the narcissistic personality. By narcissistic one, obviously he's referring, you know, to Narcissus out of Greek mythology, just as Oedipus and the other archetypes that you find in Greek mythology. All right. Now, how does he define the narcissistic personality? He argues this way, that the new narcissist, he said, is haunted not by guilt. He says psychology has removed guilt from the scene, which I think is an accurate description. He's not motivated by guilt, but by anxiety. He seeks not to inflict his own certainties on others, but to find a new meaning in life. He's liberated from the superstitions of the past, but still doubts even the reality of his own existence. His sexual attitudes are permissive rather than puritanical, which he saw as a gain. But then Lash says, even though his emancipation from ancient taboos brings him no sexual peace, he extols cooperation and teamwork while harboring deeply antisocial impulses. And here I think is probably the most important part, acquisitive in the sense that his cravings have no limits. He does not accumulate goods and provisions against the future in the manner of, let's say, the 19th century individualist, but he demands immediate gratification and lives in a state of restless, perpetually unsatisfied desire. That's a crucial point that he mentions, and I think did you take 81 with me? Well, you've heard my Web 1 lecture, but really, what it is a completion of what Thorstein Veblen saw 70 years before, was what had happened in American life or in any Western industrialized society, was that people no longer measured their worth or their value by what they could contribute to society, what you brought to society, and what you could give by way of inventions or, you know, innovations or significant contributions to the good of society, but you measured your worth and your value by what you took out of society, by how much money you had. You measured your worth, for instance, if you were a banker, by how little time you could spend at the job instead of how much time you spend at the bank. For instance, if you were really at the top, you'd come in at 10 and leave at 2. But the janitor would come in at 6 and, you know, it leave at 5. How little you had to do with this. Your determination of success in life being measured by, as I say, by how little one had to work or how much in worldly goods one had accumulated for oneself. In other words, as Veblen referred to it way back when, our old friend, you remember, conspicuous consumption. You demonstrated your worth or your value to society in what you consumed rather than what you produced. And to Lash, this has reached, you know, epidemic proportions, the whole subject that we know so well of consumptionism. All right. Now, what's wrong with that? It's good for the economy, isn't it? People keep spending, you know, get out there and keep the GNP growing. What is it, 5% a year it's supposed to grow or something? Isn't that so? He argues this. The narcissist has no interest in the future because he has also very little interest in the past. And the enemy really here is consumptionism. In other words, Lash puts it this way, to keep the American economy thriving, there must be economic growth, as we just said. To have growth, there must be a willingness on the part of the public to consider the purchase and use of today's goods and merchandise as indispensable to one's own sense of well-being. That is, you can't really have a high value or a significant sense of your own worth or importance unless you become an intelligent, wise consumer who demonstrates his or her own worth to the world by showing through consumption that you really understand what all this is about. In other words, that unless one takes advantage right now, you see, of everything the market has to offer, one loses whatever happiness and satisfaction there is in life. And Lash uses a couple of examples here from advertising as a way of demonstrating this sort of need for instant gratification of everything. If I have but one life to live, let me live it as a blonde. As an example of that, no interest in the future, interest only now in immediate gratification, or for an expensive shampoo, the best one of all. It costs more, but I'm worth it. Bourgeois capitalism, he says, thrives on and grows on this sense of creating needs, you see, with a promise of happiness for the individual consumer. One is told that he or she is entitled to be happy, to enjoy the good life, to enjoy it all right now because it might not be here tomorrow. You know, if I only, well, as I said that one, or if you only go around once in life, you know, grab all the gusto you can get. The old Schlitz beer one is another illustration of this. All right, hence, you see, the repudiation of the future. That's what he means by the narcissist not having any real interest in the future. The repudiation of the future, we don't have to worry about using up the resources, according to this argument, because somehow technology, you know, will find a way through for us. Just like we're confident that if we spend enough money, they're going to find a substitute for oil from the Middle East, with this sort of thing. Nor do we have to really be bound, for instance, by the past either, as long as not being bound about worrying about the future. Because the past put all kinds of emphasis on thrift, on self-discipline, on hard work, and those values don't bring instant happiness. This is what I want to talk about next time, and the change in the work ethic. The way he entitles it, the shift, as he called it, from Horatio Alger to the happy hooker, as a change in what's happening to the work ethic. It's maybe a little bait that can make you come next time. All right, with us. All right, hence, with no real interest in the past or with the future, we have a preoccupation, you see, for doing something good for oneself right now by focusing on what I have or what I want. And therefore abandoning any hope that involvement in, let's say, our political or our educational life can contribute to our sense of well-being. Because we know, according to the familiar diagnosis, that all our major institutions are corrupt, therefore the turn inward, the preoccupation with the self, with the emergence of this kind of narcissistic preoccupation with what the individual wants right now. All right, let me rephrase this, and I want to quote him because this is a crucial explanation of his. After the political turmoil of the 60s, Americans have retreated into purely personal preoccupations, having no hope of improving their lives in any of the ways that matter. That's a crucial statement that he says we retreated from politics, where we could really get significant things done. Having no hope of improving lives in the ways that matter, people have convinced themselves that what really matters is psychic self-improvement, getting in touch with your feelings, eating health food, taking lessons in ballet or belly dancing, immersing oneself in the wisdom of the East, jogging, learning how to relate, overcoming the fear of pleasure. Lash says this, and I quote, "Harmless in themselves, these pure pursuits, elevated to a program and wrapped in the rhetoric of authenticity and awareness, signify a retreat from politics and a repudiation of the recent past. To live for the moment is the prevailing passion, to live for yourself, not for your predecessors or posterity. We are fast losing," he said, "the sense of historical continuity, the sense of belonging to a succession of generations originating in the past and stretching into the future." Now, he obviously, that's a sweeping generalization. He has to have some evidence for this, and I quote him on this. "The contemporary climate," and this is crucial really for his argument, "the contemporary climate is therapeutic, not religious. People today hunger not for personal salvation, let alone for the restoration of an earlier golden age, but for the feeling, the momentary illusion of personal well-being, health, and psychic security. Psychological man, in other words, has replaced economic man." Quote, "People today complain of an inability to feel. They cultivate more vivid experiences, such things, for instance, as rolfing." You know this one where you get in touch with your feelings through all kinds of muscle exercises and thumping and various things carrying on with this. Or the primal scream, you know the primal scream, where you just go in and scream for a while? They have one of these in Minneapolis, or St. Paul, I'm sorry, and just, you know, let it all out with this. "They cultivate more vivid experiences, seek to beak sluggish flesh to life, attempt to revive jaded appetites. Outwardly bland, submissive and social, they seethe with an inner anger for which a dense, overpopulated, bureaucratic society can devise few legitimate outlets." And that's going to lead to what I want to talk about in the third period, the outlet of sports as an example of some of the problems we're facing today. All right, back to the argument. Plagued by anxiety, depression, vague discontents, a sense of inner emptiness, the psychological man turns to therapists, not priests, as his principal allies in the struggle for composure. From them, he hopes to achieve the modern equivalent of salvation, that is, you know, mental health. Therapy has established itself as a successor both to rugged individualism and to religion. But this does not mean that the triumph of the therapist has become a new religion in its own right. This is a key sentence here. Therapy constitutes an anti-religion because it is preoccupied only with the here and now and gives no thought to anything beyond its immediate needs. It hardly occurs to the therapist to encourage the client to subordinate his needs and interests to those of others. to someone or to some cause or tradition outside himself. Love as self-sacrifice, or meaning as submission to a higher loyalty. These sublimations strike the therapeutic sensibility as intolerably oppressive, offensive to common sense, and injurious to personal health and well-being. To liberate humanity from such outmoded ideas of love and duty has become the mission of the post-Freudian therapists, for whom mental health means the overthrow of inhibitions and the immediate gratification of every impulse. In other words, Lash is arguing that the coming together of several major forces in our times has created the narcissistic personality. Let me just quickly review here. He argues, first of all, that therapy substituting for religious faith contributes to the narcissistic personality. Secondly, consumptionism as one statement to the world of one who is, rather than your statement being made in what you contribute to the good of the community. Third, the loss of faith in the older governing institutions. Fourth, the conclusion that given the crisis we face in ecology, energy, the disappearance of natural resources, and so on, we really have no future to live for, so live only for today. All these, he argues, have combined or coalesced in the 1970s, and the response shows up in the form of narcissism, as he defines that condition. In other words, this is why it happened when it did. The older sources of loyalty, of governance, such as family, self-sacrifice, denial of instant gratification, living for others, reforming the programs of society through organized politics, you see, which requires compromise, all of these, to Lash, have virtually disappeared or lost their appeal or credibility to today's narcissistic person. All right. Of these new forces, it is the psychology of self-help that has perhaps done the heaviest damage to the older values and loyalties. The primary goal of self-help, of much of today's therapy, is, the release of tension. The assumption that our maladies or problems are really the result of our building up fierce hatreds or anxieties, and the need to release these in a socially constructive way. Modern therapy argues the client or patient is entitled to release these tensions, this rage. Otherwise, the client would suffer a severe neurosis, even psychosis. Thus, the gratification of one's own personal feelings becomes the goal. As I have said, one is entitled to feel good, to have one's own way, to pursue one's own interests in the name of mental health. The truly successful person is the one who has achieved this equilibrium within oneself, to like oneself, to indeed to be in love with oneself, which of course Narcissus was. That is the narcissistic personality. This self-image is enhanced, flattered, and strengthened, you see, by consumptionist advertising. That's where the combination comes in with consumptionism and self-help at the same time. To overcome the guilt one might otherwise feel in spending, a great deal for oneself, for dress, cosmetics, car, amusements, or all the rest, the argument goes that you're entitled to do this, and you're helping yourself by doing this. One is entitled to spending oneself on this. Did you go along on that Burnsville trip? Oh, anyway, in American Studies, what we do, there's a temple of consumptionism just 26 miles away in Burnsville, simply called Burnsville Center. And what I had the students in American Studies do on a field trip is to notice the ways in which they make spending, fun. Sort of to remove any sort of sense of guilt or pain or anything else like this by making it an adventure. I mean, there's never any, there aren't any windows, there are no clocks. You can always see other people spending. And if other people are spending, so it's okay if you spend, like this. And we had a marvelous time with that. The same thing, of course, is true, of course, for credit cards as a way of alleviating guilt. We talked about, you said you don't pay for gas. You just give them a little card and somehow they pay for it. All right. With this. All right. Beyond that, the narcissist has to deny that in any way this pursuit of self-gratification, you see, is morally wrong. Now, how can you do that? By following one school of therapy which denies the finality or absoluteness, you see, of specific principles of morality. To the narcissist, morality is simply old-fashioned, outworn dogmas from a time when organized religion dominated society. And you know what a mess the churches have made of the world today. Okay. Now, with the insights of psychology and the advances of technology, modern man is liberated from such ideas. Jerry Rubin's famous dictum, if it feels good, do it. If someone else close to you has a problem, then the narcissist's response is not one of trying to share or to help carry this. But instead, the narcissist response is to use the phrase, that's your problem. Many of us, have ever heard, that's almost everywhere in our jargon today. In other words, narcissism is the denial of personal responsibility in a moral sense for what is wrong with the world. Each person must pursue her or his own interests and goals, and if somewhere along the line one can find someone else who is willing or is tuned in to the same search, one can share this pursuit.
then out of that maybe can come friendship or even a permanent relationship. If not, then it's too bad, but the search for fulfillment, personal fulfillment, must dominate. Let me read, for instance, as a way of illustration for this, the famous Gestalt Period, you know, of Fritz Perls. This is a marvelous illustration of what I'm trying to say here. To sum up the whole, now, I'm not going to sum up, but it sums up what I've said so far. I do my thing, and you do your thing. I am not in this world to live up to your expectations, and you are not in this world to live up to mine. You are you, and I am I. And if, by chance, we find each other, it's beautiful. If not, it can't be helped. What we have here, by my way of editorial comment, is a rejection, you see, of life and community and responsibility. It defines freedom as purely personal, self-fulfillment as the absence of constraint. And at the bottom, it really isn't freedom, because it's fatalism. You know, it can't be helped with this. All right. And some Lash is saying here, and I quote, narcissism appears realistically to represent the best way of coping with the tensions and anxieties of modern life, and prevailing social conditions therefore tend to bring out narcissistic traits that are present in varying degrees to everyone. With this, I think I'll skip that and come finally to the conclusion here with this. The ethic of self-preservation and psychic survival is rooted then not in the objective conditions of economic warfare, rising rates of crime and social chaos, but in the social subjective experience of emptiness and isolation. It reflects a conviction that envy and exploitation dominate even the most intimate relations, which I think is a remarkable insight. The cult of personal relations, which becomes increasingly as intense as the hope of political solutions recedes, conceals a thoroughgoing disenchantment with personal relations. In other words, the more we are preoccupied with the cult of improving personal relationships, the less confidence we really, you know, we really have in it in itself. Just as the cult of sensuality replies a repudiation of sensuality in all but its most primitive forms. And the last sentence, the ideology of personal growth, superficially optimistic, radiates a profound despair and resignation. It is a faith of those without faith. So we've got plenty of time for consideration of his diagnosis. Briefly, that what's happened in our day, that with a repudiation that anything really significant can be done through politics, and with the belief that fulfillment of economic needs leaves us empty, we have turned primarily to fulfillment and meaning through the whole field of improving our mental health through this kind of self-help program in psychology, which he argues is a repudiation of the sort of the moral demands which a successful kind of society really needs and expects of us. Anyway, that's wrong. Yeah. That's so important that the fear of failure failure, you see, given this idea that everything can be interpreted and understood in terms of one's psychic, you know, state of mind or one's psychic well-being, then failure is no longer simply an admission that maybe you made the wrong decision on some major economic or social or you know, diplomatic issue or something else, but that failure is a result of some sort of failure of your psyche, or you're not well adjusted any longer. And that God forbid, that's the worst thing that could happen to us, is that we're no longer well adjusted, or we're no longer able to you know, as I say, get in touch with our feelings, because there is a kind of a triumphalism here, I think, in this idea that, and this isn't, Thomas heard this, but I don't want to keep saying that all the time, but anyway, there is an old, and how shall I say this, well-known trait in the American character going really back to Benjamin Franklin, which argues that if you can find the right formula, if you can find sort of the right step-by-step way in solving your problems, that it's almost automatic that you will be able to come to terms with your problems. You will be able to master, you know, your environment and make the world, you know, go in your direction. You remember Benjamin Franklin in his autobiography practiced cultivating one virtue each week. What did he have? 12 virtues, I think, altogether. And he was going to perfect one each week. And then by the time he got through with the 12th one, he found that he had slipped pretty badly on the first one, and so on. But, Donald Meyer has this book called, the positive thinkers, in which the idea is that in America, since all things are possible, we can conquer the frontier, you know, we can build skyscrapers, we can do all these enormous things. We can also conquer the frontier, if you like, or the unknown of the mind. Well, all we need is the right formula. Just like to build a railroad, all you needed was the right, you know, technological input in enough capital. And a lot of people believed this. And, of course, this is, you know, Norman Vincent Peale stuff all the way through. Maybe out here I can deliver my annual attack on Norman Vincent Peale. I always do that in my American religious history course. But, you know, you can if you think you can. And therefore, if you can't, there's something wrong not with your basic ideas as to, you know, an economic or a political solution to a problem, but with the fact that you really haven't got a hold of yourself and you know, got yourself under control. And because all these things are available to you, all you know, and you can take your, you know, your pick. I'm sure this is true in other cities like Seattle or Chicago or whatever, but another one of my favorite examples of what I'm getting at here is that it's at 6910 Xerxes Avenue near Southdale, getting in touch through movement or something, you know, or the whatever it might be. It's just available for you in this, you know, in this place, and they're doing, you know, a land office business with this kind of stuff. And I think it's growing. Or my other example is very unscientific, is that in Southdale they have they had the first of what is now a national chain, the B. Dalton bookstores. They actually got started with Dayton's in Minneapolis, and now there are about 150 or so of them all around the country. And the first island of books dealing with self-help was only they only had one island of self-help books in about 1972 or 73. And just before Christmas, I went into B. Dalton, and now there are six islands of books, you know, dealing with self-help of any kind or stripe or variety. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, you can do it through you know, through diet. You can do it through exercise. You can do it through some sort of getting in touch with the infinite. It's a colossal supermarket of just about anything you want to be able to do. And the interesting thing is that you know, people are buying this sort of thing. And then next week, for by way of previews of coming attractions, we'll take up Lash's basis thesis as it applies also to the whole field of sport and you know, recreation, leisure, time, entertainment, all that, you know, in our country. Okay, remember last time he was just very briefly he was talking about the rise of what he calls the narcissist personality in our times, and he argued that we had shifted from economic man to psychological man. That is, it was more important now to have sort of success and achievement in terms of psychological well-being than it was in terms of economic achievement. I'll talk a little bit more about that, a great deal about more about that later. And also the fact that this was enhanced by the trend that become so clear in our life of people not being able to identify with either the past or the future, because the future seems so ominous and beyond any kind of control, that they have virtually devoted themselves to, you know, living for today. And I think that's a good and enjoying everything, you know, the Schlitz thing we talked about last time, go on for all the gusto and you can get. That's a good way to sort of lead into what I want to talk about, you know, today. Basically, tonight, the work ethic. Now, what Alasha argues, and then I want to do a lot of background on this, is that in our day, what has really been almost completely transformed is something which is a really sort of unique characteristic or trait of Americans, which he refers to as the work ethic. Sometimes this has been referred to as the Protestant ethic. Sometimes it's been referred to as the Puritan ethic, for reasons I'll talk about a little bit later. But I think for our purposes, we can call it the work ethic. Because of one thing I read once, there's a very distinguished intellectual in New York named Irving Kristol, and he's of the Judaic faith, and he was reading about the Puritan ethic and the Protestant ethic, and he said, well, that could be the Jewish work ethic just as well as it could be the others, so for practical purposes, we'll refer to it as the work ethic. Okay, a little bit about the historical background with the work ethic in this country, because by contrast, but this is the point, by contrast to other cultures, not so much now, because if you go to Japan, you can't even tell the difference between, you know, the American work ethic of 20 years ago and what you see in Japan now or something else. But by contrast to many other countries, the work ethic really is uniquely American. it's something that got started here, and we exported it for better or worse to many other parts of the country, around the world, I should say. I could tell many stories about seeing the work ethic not in operation in northern Thailand. It just isn't there. They just had no sense of 8 to 5 or any saving or anything like that. They had a totally different thing. So I really think it is an American sort of thing. All right. Now, anyway, the Puritans were the first really to spell out in any kind of systematic detail what the work ethic is. This is sometimes how we call it, the work ethic, because the Puritans who came over from England to the colonies starting in the 1630s and 40s and all the rest, were convinced that everything that happened in life had a theological explanation, that there were no sort of loose ends or unexplainable kinds of circumstances in our life that couldn't be explained by something that God had created for people to understand. And therefore, everything that happened in life, no matter how trivial or menial it seemed to be, was tied to a larger framework or tied to a larger pattern, which all reflected to the glory of God itself. We want to look at how they explained and interpreted the economic situation in which they found themselves, and how they put this into sort of theological terms, because I think it's clear that right from the beginning down really to our day, the beginnings of the Puritan work ethic can be traced right to this particular period. Right. They came to the New World, and what they found after the first couple of years, and the first couple of years it really was pretty bad with the howling wilderness and all the rest, but after the first couple of years, is what they found by contrast to England, was that they discovered a very well-stocked, well-endowed physical environment. I mean, there were really significant economic opportunities here, not only in farming, but in fishing, in lumber, in furs, in many different areas. Suddenly they realized that this was indeed a very special kind of place. The whole theme, of course, of the cornucopia that we identify with Thanksgiving, which we identify also, of course, with the Puritans. All right. Now, the point is that they had to explain why it was that God had created such an abundant, well-stocked, well-endowed land. Why should all this be there? And the only people who sort of standing in the way with the American Indians, and they didn't worry about that too much with them. So why all this this richness in economic opportunity? The explanation was in the what we call today the doctrine of stewardship. They put everything in terms of doctrines, and they had the doctrine of stewardship, of course, which depends on the parable of the talents. That you remember in the parable of the talents. There were people who received 2 talents, people who received 5 talents, and people who, one person received 1 talent. And what happened was that the one who had 2 talents turned it into 4, the one who was given 5 talents turned it into 10, and all what happened to the person who was only given 1 talent. Went out and buried it, and he was cast, into outer darkness. So they took that as a direct sign, not only a sign, but a command, from God, to develop and to expand the kingdom of God in many different ways, not only to preach the word and convert people and all the rest, but also to expand economic opportunity. In other words, to use the land and its resources to enhance the glory of God, because everything in life was to be aimed, at this kind of glorification. And therefore, they didn't separate out their different parts of life, saying, I'm working here, today I work in the field for a while, then I'm going to sort of be religious by going to church or something. Everything was devoted, towards the idea of using it to glorify God itself. All right. Now, in order to be successful, in order to turn 2 talents into 4 or 5 into 10, they soon discovered that this required a certain kind of, a certain kind of temperament, a certain set of character traits or values, which were required of them in order to be successful, in expanding and developing the resources that they found here. All right. And it is these set of values, these priorities, is what I really want to say, that we usually identify as the Puritan ethic, and then for reasons we'll talk about in a minute, it becomes the work ethic. We were this. The values which we associate with the work ethic really would be thrift, that nothing could go to waste, waste not, want not, is an old traditional New England kind of thing. And also what we would call industry, but by industry they didn't mean, manufacturing or anything else like that. They meant hard work. Thrift, hard work, self-discipline, and perhaps just about as important as any of them, denial of instant gratification for enjoyment later down the, down the road. The Puritans were famous for this, and this is what is so unique about, the sort of the American quality of this, because if any of you have been in, totally different cultures, that they aren't worried at all about, manana, or anything, it's right here now for this. But hard work, thrift, saving. Remember in Minneapolis, the ad for the bank, Tuckabuckadilly, and now it would have to be about $2, I guess, and whatever. And you can find this, expressed in a lot of different hymns. For instance, Work for the Night is Coming. I wish I had a copy of that because it's so classic. It starts off with work in the morning and work at the noonday sun and work until evening falls, and then finally at the very end, when man's work is done. But you just keep working, right up until the end. Or another one I'm sure many of you know, Bringing in the Sheaves is a good example of this sort of thing. If you ever pay very careful attention to Mormon hymns, the work ethic is extremely strong. I suppose the work ethic is a livelier and more thriving, out in Utah in America than it is anywhere else, because the Puritans are so dedicated to this. All right, now, the question becomes, why did this kind of work ethic, these kinds of character traits that are talked about, hard work, thrift, discipline, self-denial of instant gratification, all these things, why did they catch on in this country? Because if it wasn't, sort of a pleasant life for those who, were dedicated to this sort of thing, the Puritans and others really did work hard. They did deny themselves, many of the pleasures and the rewards and the satisfactions of this life, with the idea being that there would be greater rewards, in the hereafter. What they discovered, and this is so important because it's changed so much for today, what they discovered was in this country, by contrast to Europe, that a person in this country, if he or she wanted to work hard enough, could, rise as high on what we would call the economic ladder as their ability would take them. It didn't matter what your family background was, it didn't matter what class in society into which you were born, it didn't matter, how much formal education you had or anything else like this, but in this country, and this is so true, and of course many people still believe this today, in this country they found there were no built-in barriers or restrictions to carrying them really to the top. In Europe, for instance, they had, feudal society, they had the nobility, and the titles were handed down from one generation, to the next, and if you weren't in the nobility, you had a very difficult time, breaking in. They had the state church, which was a very conservative kind of force. They had, many of these countries had standing armies. There's another example. These are usually considered to be the three, greatest supports for a very conservative, not only, I really should say, reactionary kind of government. But they didn't. None of these were present in this country. So therefore, if you wanted to work hard, save, all these things, you could move up on the socioeconomic kind of ladder. I remember when I graduated from high school, my father gave me what he thought was his most profound piece of advice. He sort of kicked me in the pants and he said, "There's always room, son, at the top for one more good one." And that was considered to be very profound back in Kenyon, Minnesota. There's always room at the top for one more good one. And I believed it. Why not? This was 1948 it just seemed to be, right. And by, you turn that coin over, and if there's always room at the top for one more good one, that means that to be a good person means that you will succeed in life. And looking at that the other way, if you don't succeed in life in economic terms, that means there's something wrong with you in terms of your character, in terms of your dedication, in terms of your commitment to higher goals. In Northfield, for instance, Tom knows of the famous Tiny's Pool Hall, and there's one that had different signs up there, and one of which I think is so characteristically American. It says, "If you're so smart, why aren't you rich?" As an example of really what I'm trying to say here on this. In other words, in America, it's a sin to be poor. It is not only bad luck.
It's not only, you know, the flying fickles into a fate, you remember from my old days with, you know, laughing and so on, but it's a sin. It's downright not using the, you know, the resources which God has given you to do this. And if you don't believe me, just talk to some people, you know, about their attitudes towards those who are on welfare. If you ever want to get people mad in this country, is ask them their opinion of people on welfare. Let me give you one example. I was up in Alexandria, Minnesota. Many of you know it, about the late 60s, I guess, or something, and I was standing in the post office in line and going to buy some stamps, and when I got to the counter, I gave so much and asked for so many stamps, and I had forgotten that the price of stamps had gone up. And I just said, you know, to nobody in particular, I said, boy, prices just keep going up all the time, don't they? And this one woman about 50 years old just looked at me fiercely, and she said, it's all these damn people on welfare. You know, that was her explanation for everything that was, you know, wrong and inflationary in American life. All these people on welfare. I didn't know what to say. I sort of mumbled and got out of there as fast as I could before you know, something worse would happen. I didn't know where this. All right. In other words, in this country, people who got ahead, you see, did so on the basis of their habits of sobriety, industry, you know, moderation, self-discipline, not on the basis of, you know, of self-gratification. One route for the future, you see, shunning self-indulgence in favor of patient painstaking accumulation. You know, invest now, you know, benefit later, when the investment had paid off with this. And therefore, to come back just to repeat this point, because Lash shows that this, I think convincingly, this has changed, that for a long, long time in America, what really mattered by way of, you know, the way in which you measured up, the way other people evaluated and looked at you, was how great a success you were, you see, in the world of business, in the world of the economic realm itself. People were still, as Lash would call it, I suppose, being caught up in the, you know, being economic people rather than being, as we talked about already, being psychological people. And to Americans, you know, this kind of contest was a fair test, because the old myth has it in America that everybody started at the same starting line, that you all get an equal shake in life, and that if you don't get ahead as the other people, you know, it's your fault. And therefore, since everybody started at the same starting point in life, and there were, you know, just enough success stories to convince people that this sort of rags to riches, idea was a success. I mean, they did succeed, then obviously they believed this was kind of true. There was sort of a rude justice to all this sort of thing. Let me give you another example from the profound wisdom I learned when I was in Kenyon. The high school commencement speaker gave us a story. He said that life, and we all understood what he meant by life, was like a farmer taking a load of apples to market. This is good apple country up here, I guess, so we can mention it here. And there were lots of bumps and turns and corners and hard knocks and strange, unexpected occurrences along the way. But finally, the farmer got his apples to market. And what happened, the big, juicy red ones were right up in the top where they belonged, and the little, runty, wormy ones were right down on the bottom where they belonged. And that's the way life was, too. That if you were ready to take the hard knocks and the bumps and the surprises and all the rest, you'd be right up there on the top. But if you were just a little worm, you know, and didn't know how to take care of yourself, you'd be down on the bottom where you belonged. It was, you know, really as simple about that as that. All right. Now, there was one qualification I want to make here with the Puritans. The Puritans argued, and this is, I'm getting ahead of myself here. The Puritans argued, you see, that this measure of success was valid so long as your highest good, your highest achievement in life, was to be a success, but then to give, you know, your successes, the fruits, the harvest of your success, you know, to God. That you worked hard not to benefit yourself, but you worked hard, you know, for the glory of God, to be able to show to the world that you really understood that God had given you these particular kinds of talents, and that therefore you were, by being a success in life, reflecting the glory of God in your life. And there was a kind of a rough equalitarian control, you see, over the economic appetites of people in New England. There was a famous case in 1648 where one entrepreneur named Richard Keene, I don't know if you read him in that class, but named Richard Keene sold nails for too high a profit. And he was severely punished by the Puritan community for making too much money. which is an astounding, you know, sort of thing when you stop to think of it, because we always thought that, you know, America is always the land of free enterprise, and if you can get, you know, 10 cents a pound more for meals than your competitor, that's his problem, you know, why not try to do it? But the Puritans didn't see it that way. They said there was a proper margin, you see, for profit, and that if necessary, the community would step in and regulate that kind of profit. In other words, the welfare of the community, you see, came first. And if people were charging too much, then they would simply have to be put down with this. All right. Now, what happens to this idea of success, you see, this stature and importance through economic success, is that it becomes secularized really in about the 18th century. Okay, now, what do I mean by that? Always in the doctrine of stewardship, there was the idea that no matter what your calling in life was, be it, you remember, and Luther had this, of course, very strongly, and the Puritans really adopted this from Luther and then developed it with Calvin, too. But anyway, no matter what your calling in life was, you were to be the very best of what you were called to be it street sweeper, you know, farmer, homemaker, fisherman, whatever it was, you were expected to be your very best, because in that way you were, you know, reflecting the talents that had God had given you. All right. And it wasn't very difficult, obviously, to measure, you know, let's say, how successful a farmer was, or how successful, let's say, a fisherman was. Those were fairly easy. But how do you measure, you see, how successful a businessman is? The way you measure it is to determine, you know, how much money he makes. And therefore, that's a very sort of worldly or secular kind of standard. And therefore, even the Puritan businessmen came to the conclusion that the way in which you measured how good you were, who the best was by the amount of money, you see, that you made, the amount of wealth that you accumulated, really, you know, for yourself. And therefore, the old Puritan idea about giving your best, you see, to the community and therefore to God, was turned around. And now, by the 18th century, almost all of old Puritan theology had gone out of date anyway, and sort of a secular version of the work ethic was left. That you always did your very best, you know, self-discipline, all thrift, industry, sobriety, all these things that I talked about, because you had a fair chance in life, just as everybody else did, and if you succeeded, that meant that you deserved to be wealthy. We were this. And I suggest that you know, people really believe this because, as I mentioned a little bit before, there were enough sort of success stories in America, you know, to give this credence. I mean, there were people who went from log cabin to White House. I often, you know, wonder about college educations when you start to think that Abraham Lincoln had less than 9 months of formal education. Which makes you wonder if it's important to go to school. If you can turn out like Abraham Lincoln and, you know, and have only 9 months of education, well, you know, it says something. Or probably one of the, you know, in the late 19th century, we had all kinds of success stories. One of the most famous was Andrew Carnegie. He literally started off when he was in Scotland at $1.20 a week as a bobbin boy in a cotton manufacturing factory. And by the time he was done, he sold out to U.S. Steel for $497 million. You know, he took his money home after work. He didn't belly up to the bar, you know, for a pitcher of beer with the boys. He went home and he invested that money. And he didn't have the pleasure of a bucket of beer right after, you know, 10 or 12 days in the sweatshop. But he had the pleasure of knowing that his investment was growing and that, you know, he made it really right to the top with us. All right. So much really for the background, probably too much background on this. But I think the work ethic lasted for such a long time in our country because, as I say, there were enough success stories. And who was this guy with computers down in Texas? Perot, isn't that his name? Yeah, you know, people think, well, there are no more millionaires, but once in a great while, a millionaire comes along, and everybody says, well, that means that the system is still working, because we're still getting millionaires, and I'm sure, Shanna's telling me that there must be some millionaires on the gold market today. We went over $800, did you say, today? So, you know, check out your grandma's earrings, folks, and see what they've got, but anyway, now, What Lash argues, and then I'll just give the explanation and then go back into the reasons for this. What Lash argues is that the work ethic has really almost totally disappeared in America today, with a few exceptions. And I'm sure you can all think of exceptions to this, but with a few exceptions, it really has disappeared for several reasons. For one thing, he argues, and I think that much of this is very, very convincing, He said, most or many people can no longer really identify their lives or their personalities with the kind of work that they do. Because so much of work in our society, even white-collar work, not only in factories, but white-collar work too, white-collar work is so routine, so standardized, so bureaucratic, that anybody with some background or some experience can do it, and it's very easy, and people often too move from one kind of industry or product to another without any great difficulty, because all the work has become so made so standardized, so routine. Let me give you just a couple of examples of what I mean. When I quoted my father, I should quote something on the positive side, I suppose, too, of what he believed in. And he was always a hardware man. I mean, he wasn't just a Main Street merchant or anything else. His field was hardware, and he wanted to provide the best services and the best hardware he could for the people. And he saw himself as a hardware man. And I wondered sometimes why he would go in the dead of winter up to the annual Minnesota State Hardware Convention. And it's because he wanted to identify and rub shoulders with other hardware people. He felt very, very comfortable with them. Or another one would be an even better one, because it's sort of a rags to riches story, which I've been talking about here. The original founder of Ralston Purina was a man by the name of William Danforth. I don't know if any of you read I Dare You. Oh, well, I could go on a long thing here, because I got a Danforth Fellowship. But anyway, and we all had to go out to camp in the summertime, and we all met the old man, and he'd tell us his old stories and little pep things. And he always was so fond of, as he called her, Joan of Arc. He wasn't, what you call highly literate, but he certainly was highly prosperous. But anyway, what was interesting with Mr. Danforth was that in Ralston Purina, if some of you don't know, is Ralston Breakfast Food, Corn Chicks, and Rye Crisp, and All You Add Is Love, all these things, and then Hog Chow and Chicken Feed, and all these different things that they make down in St. Louis at Checkerboard Square, and so on. But anyway, in Who's Who in America, the founder of the company. I should say the grandfather, because just by way of parenthetical remark, it's a Danforth, the grandson, who's a United States Senator from Missouri, right now. It's kind of an interesting follow-through there. One of the distinguished families, really, in Missouri. Okay, but anyway, grandfather Danforth put himself down in Who's Who in America as a miller. That's what he did. I mean, farmers brought grain to market, and he milled it and sent it back out in the form of breakfast food or, Purina Hog Chow or whatever it might be. But he identified, like my father did, with the product itself. All right. What was interesting was his son, Donald Danforth, just retired a couple of years ago as chairman of the board, listed himself in Who's Who in America as a business executive. He no longer identified with the product, but he identified with the process. That went along with the job itself. And we all know how easy it is for people to move, from one industry to another. It isn't the product, you see, that's important anymore, like motors or like building or whatever it might be, but it's this bureaucratic, structure that goes into this sort of thing. And therefore, since this is true, and you can point some of, Kafka's famous novel, The Castle, and this fantastic scene, where people are totally caught up in this impersonal world, that means that people can no longer sort of directly identify, with a job. And they how do you expect them to take, real pride in their work when their work, and their own skills are so interchangeable? It's very difficult to do. And that's one factor that Lash mentions, why the old Puritan work ethic is disappearing. Secondly, he argues, and we talked about this last time, so I'll just briefly mention it and then tie it into the economic side of it here. He argues that with no faith, the narcissistic people having no faith in a productive future, we can no longer sort of really believe that there is going to be a future out there. He argues that self-preservation, you see, has replaced self-improvement as the goal of earthly existence. That is, we work now simply to preserve ourselves, not to improve society. Why bother improving society? It's run by untrustworthy people anyway. We don't really believe that there's going to be a future. So therefore, with the goal of self-preservation rather than improvement as being dominant in our society, we lose interest, you see, in making the best possible product. and simply try to accumulate as much wealth in good times as possible. Or a third explanation, I think, is good here, and it gets us into the psychological side of this sort of thing. The older traditional work ethic, which I talked about, really reflected what David Riesman once called, the inner directed person. That is, if a person was really sure of his or her own, objectives and goals in life, they didn't really care what other people thought about them. They were inner directed. The great tycoons like Ford, like Frick, like Carnegie, the Rockefellers and all these people, they were inner directed. They didn't really much care, what other people thought, because they were so sure that what they were doing was right, and thus they simply went ahead with this. Now, what Lash argues is that sort of inner-directed person has changed almost completely. Most people today are what he calls other-directed. That is, they take their clues to their own identity, their own sort of view or understanding of who they are, on the basis of what other people think about them. They are other-directed. Their clues, their identity towards how well they're doing in life, how successful they are, how well-liked they are, how popular they are, all of these things really depend on what other people think about you rather than really what you think about yourself. Because we've become so sensitive, to sort of these signals that our psychological antenna hold out for us with this. All right, and I'll quote him here. "We anxiously scan the face of our fellows not to evaluate their credit, but in order to gauge their susceptibility to our own blandishments. In other words, what he's arguing here is that in the classic line here, the narcissist practices the classic arts of seduction, hoping to win your heart while picking your pocket. And the title for his chapter here that I promised you last week and I'm delivering this week, he says this: "The happy hooker stands in place of Horatio Alger as a prototype of personal success." Now, what he means there is that it is no longer the Horatio Alger, the log cabin to White House, $1.20 to, president of U.S. Steel, kind of prototype that dominates the way we think about our work and our self. But it's the happy hooker kind of mentality, which I'll talk about a little bit later. He argued, when did this, he argues that this took place, he says, about the time of Dale Carnegie and others like Norman Vincent Peale, with this positive thinking. All right. Because he argues that once you buy the Dale Carnegie message, and you remember what he said about Jesus, he was the greatest salesman who ever lived. He took 12 men and they turned it into the greatest institution that the world has ever seen. He had a very good product and he knew how to sell it. And sometime read The Man Nobody Knows. Jesus was the most popular dinner guest in Jerusalem, which I think would be news to many New Testament scholars. Because he didn't seem to be too popular, but with the upper class. But anyway, Dale Carnegie takes the idea that it is no longer the product that matters so far as your own success and stability and advancement in this world is concerned, but it is your selling of yourself. You're selling or developing certain skills so that you know how to sell the product, even though the customer itself might not really want it. And this was so brilliantly, of course, portrayed by Arthur Miller in Death of a Salesman, in which Willie Lohman, if you ever thought of it, you don't know what the product is in Death of a Salesman, that Willie was saying. The product is never identified. I blandly said in class one day, I don't know if you were in that class that day, Tom, did we take it up when you were in 31, Death of a Salesman? Okay. But anyway, I thought it was shoes, but I have no idea. I think in the movie, wasn't it Lee Cobb who played Willie in the movie? And I think it was shoes, but it doesn't really matter here. But the point is that Willie believed that if he were a good enough person, if he were hardworking, popular, well-liked, all these things, he couldn't help but sell. He couldn't help but be a success. It was the kind of person you were as a salesman, and hookers are salesmen, salespersons, that determines, whether or not you're going to be successful in this world. Let me give you another example. I don't know, have any of you worked for Southwestern Books in the summertime? Anyway, Eric did for 3 summers and finally left. But Southwestern sells Bibles and family books and other things, and it's a good, the product itself is good. I mean, it's a good quality. It isn't cheap quality at all, and everything. But they sell books door-to-door, and they work on 100% commission. You buy books from Southwestern, and then you don't get any salary, and then you just turn loose in Eureka, Arkansas, or wherever it is to sell us as much as possible. That's just where he worked, too, either in some unbelievable places. But the point is, and he showed me this because I'm working on something with Success in America, that Southwestern had this had the same idea that if you're a good person, you couldn't help but be a success. If you were really skilled in your arts of salesmanship, you would make a sale. It was that simple. It was called, and if you didn't succeed, it was because you didn't give a good enough sales pitch. And they simply wouldn't believe or allow this young kids, out of college to believe that people just didn't want the product. Anybody is, if you're good enough, you'll be able to convince them that they need the product, even though they might have three or four. I know Paper Moon, everybody thinks of that when they think of, door-to-door salesmen. You remember with Ryan O'Neill and so on, or something like that. But Southwestern is a very reputable organization. Don't take me wrong. They've been in business, 120 years or something, and so on. But they put forward the same idea that that's so prevalent in Death of a Salesman too. You succeed by proving yourself, by winning friends and influencing people against their will. You sell them a product that they might not need, but that is to your credit, you see, since that proves that you are smarter, more engaging than they are. You learn their weakness. So this is always, a sign of a good salesperson. If you find the weakness, or you find where you can flatter them. Some people, of course, want to be flattered. That's one reason you go to some people, especially go to high-priced stores, is that the products aren't necessarily better, but they want the attention of being catered to. They want, salespeople to say around, isn't that sweet, or doesn't that make you look, 20 years younger or something else like this, and, people believe it. I mean, they don't do it at Kmart, but they do it a lot of other places. In other words, you sell them a product that they might not need, but that is to your credit, yeah. With this, the product itself is secondary. Therefore, you see, you gain self-esteem by selling an image of yourself to others. You see, the image you sell is not that of hard work, of self-discipline, of thrift, of denial, of instant gratification, but it's a, what you've really done is you've manipulated people. And you've been able to sell them, that means that you're smarter than they are, and therefore you deserve, the profits, because you sort of match wits with them and are able to do this. So I said, all right. And if some of you think this isn't the case, then I would just send you to the bestseller books lists in the country, and looking out for number one, pulling your own strings, your erroneous zones, Power Through Success, Michael Korda's book, and so on. They sell into the millions of copies with this sort of thing. And now Ringer's new book, he was the one who wrote Looking Out for Number One. Ringer's new book is selling in the millions of copies, and it's a diatribe against big government in this country. And people like to think that their faults in their life are simply due to the fact that the big government never gave them a chance. And I have to tell this one. I love to tell my stories about my hometown. But this one, we were working for the State Highway Department, and we would meet at this restaurant at about 6:30 in the morning to get a ride out to where we were going. And every morning, there was old Nellie Tooney sitting there reading the Minneapolis Morning Tribune. And Nellie would scan the paper for a while and grumble a little bit. And then he'd turn the page and he'd say, "Yeah, what are these damn British bankers doing today?" And what it came down to was that Mary was convinced that British bankers were ruling the world. It isn't Jews or Catholics or Arabs or whatever you see, but it was British bankers who were ruling the world, because a lot of people thought right after World War I that it was British bankers who got us into World War I and so on. And Mary never amounted to much in life, but he could always blame it on the British bankers, because if there hadn't been British bankers, Mary could have gone right to the top. But no way he could have, but he thought he could, and that was really more important than anything else. All right, now. All right, now, in other words, when you're able to manipulate other people, when you recognize their weaknesses and all of that, you have really, replaced the old work ethic itself. And I'll quote Glasher: "Today, men seek the kind of approval that applauds not their actions but their personal attributes. They wish not to be so much esteemed as admired." I think that's a good point. They wish not to be so much esteemed as admired. It's image is all today. "They want to be envied rather than respected." "Pride and acquisitiveness, the sins of an ascendant capitalism, have given away to vanity. People have gotten themselves into this kind of situation. All right. And what has happened is that this whole sort of replacement of the old work ethic with this new kind of ethic of personal success through manipulation and cleverness is reinforced, of course, by the whole world of advertising that people are entitled to this sort of thing. There was one way, was it Eastern Airlines, for a while, if you've got it, flaunt it. Isn't that a good example of what I'm trying to say here? In other words, success in our society has to be ratified by publicity. There are really very few obscure millionaires or tycoons left in the world of business. Once you get, in, you become, instantly well-known around the world, at least around the country. The success model, he argues, confuses successful competition of the task at hand with the impression that he hopes to make on others. We're with this. I've got a couple of examples there that I'll skip over with this because I'm talking too long. All right. And with this in mind, then, we come directly to the narcissistic, preoccupation with psychological man. With the rise of pop psychology, which, we talked about last time, it's many-form, with the idea, which I used from Tom Wolfe, let's talk about me, the me decade, with the preoccupation with mental health, et cetera, and all this. What happens is that success in the business or in the academic or in the legal or often in the medical world depends on, quote, information about the personality of the other players. It sounds like office politics, and that's exactly what it is. But you learn, in other words, to get ahead, he's arguing, not so much by what you contribute to the, the good of the company itself, but you learn the weaknesses, of those who are in the same position as you are to get ahead, and therefore you concentrate on the personality of other players. This preoccupation, as I talked about last time, with psychology. We're with this, all right. The better the corporate executive or bureaucrat understands the personal characteristics of his subordinates, the better he can exploit their mistakes in order to control them and reassert his own supremacy. That's a devastating kind of indictment, but I think there's a great deal to it. You evaluate a person on the basis of their weaknesses, and exploit these weaknesses really for your own purposes. So the world of business, or this could be in academia, goodness knows, this is just as true there, and it's certainly true in many of the other professions. So the real world out there becomes a test of egos, of being mentally healthy, of having found the right formula, which we talked about last time, which is who gives a competitor the edge over those in the same category. In other words, the success is not product nor what one contributes, but it's being able to exploit the fears, the weaknesses, and the vulnerabilities of others. And this is what gives the extra edge for victory to those who are willing to do this. All right. Now, the question, of course, becomes why. As we said last time, we were convinced that the way to measure or understand ourselves and others is not by what they contribute by way of goods or services, but, to repeat, by their psychological profile. We develop concepts or stereotypes about what makes a person do what he or she does and decide that this is what this person really is. In other words, we've really lost the older ideas of identifying a person with, her or his job or his occupation. Now it is preoccupation with motives, with weaknesses, the whole personality game. All right, now last year, explains why this sort of fundamental personality shift has taken place. Some of it, of course, happened from what we talked about last time, the shift from production to consumption. In other words, since we are now, primarily consumers, and competition prevails in trying to sell us things to consume, then advertisers and sellers have to know what makes us tick, our psychological makeup, in order to find our weaknesses and sell us what we really don't need. But we continue to buy because it enhances our self-image as persons who are really aware, sophisticated, chic, and all that sort of thing. All right, that's one reason for the shift from production to consumption and what that meant for our own habits. Secondly, he argues that the shift has taken place because of what he calls the increasingly warlike conditions of social life. That's a rather bold statement, but the warlike conditions of social life. That is, since traditional morality, we used to know it, is pretty much passé today, the old rules about fair play, honesty, simply no longer prevail. It is only squares, people who are square, who follow those. And it's what's so interesting is the shift has taken place. In the 20s, it was a good thing to be square. You were four square. And that comes, Mr. Danforth had a whole thing with that. There's a reason for the checkerboard as being the symbol for Ralston Purina. That's four square living. Live tall, think tall, act tall. What is the other one? And so on. And he got this out of this is fascinating, really. He got this out of the verse in the Bible where Jesus, as a boy, visited the temple. And remember the last description is that he increased in stature and wisdom in the eyes of God and the eyes of man.
In other words, there's physical attributes, there are social attributes, there are spiritual attributes, and there are psychological attributes. He increased in wisdom, the intellectual, and in stature, the physical, in the eyes of God, the religious, in the eyes of man, the social. So everything should be four-square living. Amy Semple McPherson didn't pick up on that from Danforth, but she had the four-square gospel right out in the West Coast with us, sort of said, all right, with us. In other words, society becomes more warlike because of the increased competition and the greater stakes that, you know, that are involved here. All right, now, where does this lead us? Let me sum up so far. In the 70s, the new exemplification of success, are these qualities indispensable to making it America, and here we tie up with the happy hooker, are exhibited by the prostitute. She sells herself for a living, as did the salesman in the 1950s, but her seductiveness hardly signifies a wish to be well-liked. She craves admiration, but scorns those who provide it, and thus derives little gratification from her social successes. She attempts to move others while herself remaining unmoved. She remains a loner, dependent on others only as a hawk depends on chickens. That's a nice metaphor. She exploits the ethic of pleasure that has replaced the ethic of achievement. But her career, more than any other, reminds us that contemporary hedonism, living for pleasure only, that contemporary hedonism originates not in the pursuit of pleasure, but in a war of all against all, in which even the most intimate encounters become a form of mutual exploitation. You are simply no longer capable of sustained self-discipline, you see, but live only for the moment. And what he argues, you see, is that the happy hooker thing is a metaphor for the idea today that using psychological insights, we judge ourselves on the skill of manipulating the feelings of others, to our advantage. This is done not only in personal relationships, through family, friends, and so on, but at work, too. Sociability becomes one more means of getting ahead, of achieving power. For instance, and I'm sure some of you have seen these, we have manuals now on, you know, how to dress for success is a big one. Or how to arrange your furniture in your office for success. There is actually a book out if you want to, you know, if you've got clients coming in or people are also, you have to arrange the furniture just right to set up the right sort of way. And Marty did a marvelous spoof on this in his memo column. He was talking about how he rearranged his furniture in his office down at the Christian Century in order to gain the upper hand, you see, over people. Once they had walked into his little den, he had them, you know, snapped up. Couldn't help it. He had his furniture arranged in just the right way. They have advice on where to stand at a cocktail party, for instance. For gaining power and success with us. Everything is on technique. Masters and Johnson's, all the rest, everything is on technique. Technique becomes the end in and of itself. And the law shows, for instance, that this trend towards technique, you see, is what explains the enormous popularity today that is associated with what we call assertiveness. Assertiveness is designed to equip the client with defenses against manipulation, which is based on the recognition, you see, that agility in interpersonal relations determines what seems to be achievement. What makes these techniques popular is not so much in their objectives, is in the anxiety to which they appeal, and the kind of reality which informs it. That is, the idea that success depends on psychological manipulation, that all of life, even in work, centers on the struggle for interpersonal advantage. This is this becomes the deadly game of intimidating friends and seducing people, which is a very dynamite kind of conclusion. That is no longer a product, it's simply a matter of intimidating friends and seducing people. In sum, the growth of bureaucracy, which I talked about before, the cult of consumption, its need for gratification, and the sevens of continuity of the past or the future have transformed the work ethic while carrying the underlying principles of capitalist society to their logical conclusion. That is, everybody's entitled to happiness, to their own happiness, thus the narcissistic personality. In the last sentence, the pursuit of self-interest, formerly associated with the pursuit of wealthy, has become a search for pleasure and psychic survival.